Jeff Reckenbach. We're here today in Washington, D.C. on September 11th, 2024, with Claude Cummings, Debbie Goldman, and Hannah Goldman to conduct an oral history interview with the president of the communications workers, Claude Cummings. 23 years ago today, you could see the smoke from the Pentagon from this vantage point right here. So. So, Claude, what we'd like to do and what we've done with everybody else that we've talked to is really start with your early life and just sort of move forward your progression, you know, how you came to be the person that you are today. So can you tell us about, you know, when you were born and where and what the circumstances were?
Sure. Again, Claude Cummings, President of Communication Workers of America. I was born in Houston, Texas. October 20th, 1951. So I am 72 years old, and a couple of months I'll be 73. Mm-hmm. Thank God for that. Mm-hmm. And lived in and again in Houston, Texas. Attended Cashmere High School, where I was active there in the ROTC, and I was also president of our class, and I was the editor for the school newspaper. So I was pretty active there. I enjoy singing, so I started singing with some guys there that I'm still singing with. But interesting times for me. We were the last midterm class to graduate from Cashmere. I actually graduated in January of 1970. Okay. We were encouraged to go to summer school. That's what I'm trying to think of. Summer school. We were encouraged to go to summer school so we would not have a midterm class. But the 69 class, which is the class we would have graduated in, had so many smart students in it. I mean, some of those that came out of that class are doctors, attorneys, and others. And so we wanted to stay with the group that we had been with for some time, because we were going to graduate at a higher percentage than we would have had we stayed in the 69 class. So we were the last midterm class to graduate from Cashmere High School. And then from there, I attended Tuskegee Institute for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I did not graduate, but it was interesting times there.
So what did your parents do?
My dad actually was a janitor for AT&T. He started working for AT&T in 1946. And as a janitor, my mother was a beautician. And my dad is one who believed that wives should work, but they should not work away from home. and my mother wanted to be a beautician, so he actually built a beauty shop for her adjacent to our home. And so she could care for us and be at home because he thought it was important that she was there to see after us. So interesting times.
So 1946 at the telephone company, as an African American, I'm guessing the jobs that were open were jobs like a janitor.
Right.
Those lower paid jobs. Am I correct in that?
That's correct. During those years, a black man could do nothing but janitorial work.
Yeah.
Now, oddly enough, I found out that there were black women that were hired to be operators during those times.
Yeah.
But black men could do nothing but janitorial work. Interesting enough, my dad's first fight was not with AT&T. It was actually with CWA. Well, one other interesting thing about my dad. My father, in the 1946-1947 time frame, was on a 15-minute break. He worked at the Capitol Building in downtown Houston. And during his break, he happened to look out the window. He worked on the first floor and saw this nice-looking woman standing at a bus stop.
Mm-hmm.
And so he started flirting with her. And flirting turned into a date. A date turned into marriage. And a couple of years later, I showed up. So I'm actually a product of both CWA and AT&T.
That's great. Yeah.
But you know, those years were tough for those janitors. And
well, you started to say his first fight
That's where I'm going. Okay. His first fight was actually with the union, because during those years, and this is of course during the years when Tommy Parsons and Joe Gunn were leading the Houston local at that time, local 6222. They met on separate nights. White men met on one night, black janitors met on another night. And everyone needs to understand clearly that those janitors had actually formed a relationship with those white technicians. They cleaned up behind them and things of that nature. So they really formed a sort of a bond. And so the question came up about why is it we're paying the same amount of dues under this dues structure, but we meet on one night and all of you meet on another night. And so the janitors actually approached the leadership at that time about a different type of arrangement. And there was pushback from them, from the leadership. Said, this is the way things are. This is the way they're going to be. And so, of course, the janitors then took the position that, well, if you're not going to change, then our idea is that we need our own union, and we're going to break away from CWA and form our own union. And so, you know, white men at that time, I would say, understood economics real well, because we had a number of black men that were janitors working at that time. And so the idea of dues being taken away, you know, did not sit well with the leadership. And the other interesting thing that happened is those white technicians in the workplace said, listen, they're right. Yeah. Why can't they meet on the same night? We work with these guys every day. Yeah. They clean up behind us. We've gotten to know them. We've gotten to know their families. There's no reason why we should meet on separate nights. Yeah. And so my dad helped lead that fight. And so that rule was changed. Hmm. And shortly after several meetings, they started all meeting on the same night at Local 6222 in Houston.
And I'm guessing, ironically, back at that time frame, it was a flat rate dues.
Yes.
So even though the janitors were paid less than the technicians, they were paying the exact same amount of dues.
Exactly.
As those
exactly
technicians
right.
were.
Exactly right.
Wow.
Yeah.
So did your father spend his entire career?
So my father started as a janitor. Mm-hmm. He moved from a janitorial position to a stockman position, and he actually would just deliver supplies to other buildings other than the Capitol building. And from there, he became a frame attendant and then a switchman. And so he actually retired as a switchman. A couple of other interesting things that happened during that process, especially as technology began to change. My dad started as a step switchman, and it was really interesting to watch him sit in a center. Mm-hmm. And you know, I get questioned all the time, and let me just talk about this for a minute. Buildings. AT&T probably has more buildings, I think, than any other business other than the U.S. government. And that's because their switches, the technology at that time was so antiquated now based on what, so much different than what we have now, I should say. And a step switch was huge. And each house had to have a step switch in order to be able to transmit a call. It had levers on it. And I would take my father lunch occasionally. And I watched him as he was eating lunch stop and listen for what he heard was a malfunctioning step switch. And I thought, all these switches that are in this building, but he can hear that there's one that is not operating properly. And I watched him walk until he found that switch and he was able to repair it. I mean, he was a hell of a technician. He really was.
Isn't that remarkable?
Very, very remarkable. Yeah. And of course, after step switches, we had crossbar switches. And my father was at a time where he was, you know, trying to think about if he was going to work longer or or how much the new technology he really wanted to try to grasp.
Mm-hmm.
And he finally made a decision that, you know, it may be time to go. But with my seniority, he had the right to stay on, you mm-hmm. know, as long as he wanted to, even if there were, you know, surpluses and things of that nature. And so what happened interesting during that period of time is he began to move around the different offices and run jumpers and, you know, preparing for the new technology that was about to take place. But management got to a place where they felt like it was just time to try to force him off the payroll.
Hmm.
Okay. So what they would do is they would send my father to school. Now, they understood clearly he didn't finish high school.
Yeah.
Right. And so the idea was to set him in these classes with white men who could read, because their thoughts were, you know, he's not going to be able to read. He's learned the job, watching others do the work, but he hasn't read, you know, to read anything that has really prepared him to be able to do this work. But they were wrong. My dad could read very well. And in some cases, when they sent him to school, he read better than some of the white technicians that were there. And at one time, he read so much better than others were in the class that the instructor got pissed off and actually shut down the class and sent everybody back to work.
Well, that's amazing.
You know, it's amazing, but those are the type of things that were, you know, taking place during that period of time.
If they made up their mind to get rid of you, they were going to figure out a way to try and do it.
In Pasadena, Texas,
mm-hmm.
My father was sent to work there again with the idea of placing him in a situation where he would feel uncomfortable. The Pasadena Greenwood office was right across the street from the White Citizens Council. And for those of you who don't know what the White Citizens Council is, it's the Ku Klux Klan.
Yeah.
And my father would get out of his car to go into that building, and he would get harassed every day. But he wouldn't say anything about it. But he would get in, and he would go to work his first, you know, several weeks there. And the more he worked, the more the technicians that were there, white technicians, got to know him and appreciate him. And so one day he was threatened with bodily harm while going into the building. And one of the white technicians heard about it. Switchman heard about it and said, "Claude, how long has this been going on?" And my dad said, "It's been going on for some time now." And so he said, why didn't you tell us so we could help you?" He said, "We're not going to let them bother you like this." Mm-hmm. And so they actually started meeting my dad in the mornings when he would drive up, walk him inside the buildings. And in the evenings, they would walk him back out to their car. And they would say to them, you know, "If you're going to mess with him, you got to mess with us first." And so that actually took place.
Wow.
And but my dad ended up retiring from that office. The Klan headquarters, you know, moved on to some other place. But those were interesting times, you know,
what a union was about, though?
I yes. Mean,
it's, you know, that's, the injury.
That's what unions are about. These co-workers step up
and the injury of one is the injury of everyone.
Right, so, right.
Very cool. So, siblings? So,
yes, I have sisters? two brothers. And one has passed on, unfortunately, from pancreatic cancer. And he actually worked for AT&T. Okay. He was a CST.
Are you the oldest of the three?
I'm the oldest.
Okay.
Yeah, I am the oldest.
I assumed when you said your father's name was Claude.
Right. Right. I'm junior.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So, and I have a son, of course. That's a third.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah. But those were interesting times. Interesting times for my dad, and I would enjoy listening to him talk about the things that he would have to deal with on the job.
Yeah.
And another interesting thing is that when I decided to run for office, many of the technicians who knew my dad but did not know me actually thought they were voting for my dad. Many of them told me, man, we had no idea we were voting for you. We thought we were voting for your dad. We were all trying to figure out what the hell is Clark going to do at this age running for a union job. But he was so well respected that they said, if he wants to run, we're going to vote for him. Simple as that. So
you really rode his coattails into office.
I rode his coattails in office. I did.
That's good to know.
I did.
So normally we do these. We start, you know, with when you're born and sort of go forward. But I have to ask you, you sent out a letter a couple of months ago that talked about voting rights and your grandparents, I think. Can you talk a little bit about that story and what they had to endure to be able to vote down in Texas?
Well, I think the what I was talking about during that period of time was I'm just so and maybe I should talk about my wife. You know, going to Tuskegee, of course, I met my wife Ruth, and Ruth is from Selma, the heart of the civil rights movement, right?
Yeah.
And she would talk about stories that of things that they had to endure as children in the civil rights movement. Ruth was involved in marches. Her brothers were involved in marches. And so she understood clearly, and her family understood clearly, that there are so many that sacrificed so much for us to be able to vote. I saw my father cry for the first time openly when Dr. King was assassinated. And that is what really got my attention about the civil rights movement and me beginning to take more interest in what the civil rights movement was about. And some might ask, well, you know, why did you decide at that time to get involved? And it's because, listen, where I lived in a community where, and I'm not sure I've answered the question yet, but I'll get there. Okay. Lived in a community that was self-sufficient. Mm-hmm. We had black stores, we had black movies, we had black tailors. I did not have to leave my community for anything. Funeral homes, grocery stores, I mean, you name it. And so I didn't see racism as my wife saw it, because we were just in a different place, you know, as far as civil rights and racism was concerned. And so after watching my dad cry after Dr. King became assassinated, it made me understand clearly that I needed to get more involved and understand clearly what this voting rights was all about, what the marches were about, and things of that nature. So so you know, of course, politics closest to your community affects you more than from a distance. I know everybody's interested in what's happening in the presidential race. I got that, but you're affected more by what happens with your city council, with your school boards, and things of that nature. Well, how do you fix some of that stuff? You know, you got to fix it through voting. And that's one of the things that I have tried to impress upon young people that don't, for whatever reason, see the importance of wanting to vote. If you want to change what's going on in your life daily, you need to vote for those who believe as you believe and who see things as you see them, because there are so many that don't, right? And if you won't make change, you can make change happen, but you've got to vote. And so that's why, you know, I've become a civil rights activist. Of course, I'm also on the board of directors of the NAACP, and you don't change things unless you get active yourself and have a conscious effort to try to get others to do what's needed to. We talk about worker power on the job all the time by being unionized and negotiating a union contract so workers will have rights. How do you have rights in your community, right? You bond together and you vote to make a difference so you can have
the power you need to effectively change those things that you see that are not right.
And so the powers that be back in the day would do everything they can, and still today
they still do. I mean, I've
got to try and restrict our right to vote.
I live in a state with a governor that's in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
That's making it more difficult for those in a wheelchair like him to vote. Yeah. How crazy is that? Yeah. And we're not just talking about black folk in a wheelchair. We're talking about white men and women that are in wheelchairs, you know, and it's making it more difficult to vote. And so why are they doing that? Because there's power in the vote. Mm-hmm. Simple as that. You know, those in this community have the power to make a difference if they use it. And so that's why I'm such an advocate for voting and mm-hmm. And fighting for voting rights, because that's how we make change in this country, through voting.
Yeah. So can you share a little bit with us about the poll tax and?
Sure. Yeah. So my father has, I have a copy of a poll tax receipt, I should say, is what it is, where he paid $1.50 back in 1946 and 47 for the right to vote. And think about that. Think about 1946, 47, $1.50. That was a lot of money back then. But he felt the importance and the need to spend that in order to have a voice on who was going to represent him, you know, in his city. And we have that right now and don't have to pay.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a shame that we don't take advantage of it.
So you literally had to pay this $1.50
in order to vote. Right.
And clearly cut out thousands of poor people who just couldn't scrape it together.
Right. And of course, you have to deal with the other stuff that comes with that.
Yeah,
you know, how many bubbles in a bottle of bubbles.
Yeah, right.
You know, how many jelly beans in a jar.
The literacy test.
The literacy test. Those kind of things actually took place.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of people don't believe it, but those things are for real. Yeah. You'd be surprised when I speak about the need to register and to vote. And I pull this out. I normally pull that poll tax receipt out and show it. Mm-hmm. How many people, especially young people, come up and take a picture of it and said, you know, I've heard these stories, but I didn't know they were true. They actually don't believe. They thought this was some type of fairy tale like Santa Claus and other things, right? They didn't know that this actually, you know, existed, and this actually happened in our, you know, in our country. Mm-hmm. And that's why it disturbs me so when I hear some say that they don't want to exercise their right now to vote free of cost. All you need to do is register. In Texas, where you know, I feel like our democracy is on the line. I feel like it's on the line in a lot of places, to be quite honest with you. But we live in a state now that has more black people living in it than any other state in this country. So we're not, and I say this all the time, we're a non-voting state. It's not that we're a red state. We're just mm-hmm. a non-voting state. We could actually become blue quick mm-hmm. if we could get those in the state that have not registered and voting, mm-hmm. registered and get them to vote.
Well, we could spend all day talking about voting.
Right.
And the power of vote. But let's go back to your life. So you leave. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, before you go back to that, I'd like to tell a story, if I could, about Ruth.
This is what it's about. Well, I was going to go to Ruth at this point. Okay. So go. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so interesting story about my wife. Her and her mother actually fed marchers that were marching and demonstrating. Ruth's home is right on Highway 80. You can see the Edmund Pettus Bridge from their homestead that's still there. And a couple of interesting things about the movement during that period of time. Ruth's father was a Methodist minister who actually planted churches around mm-hmm. Alabama. So they weren't rich, right? Mm-hmm. But they, you know, they lived comfortably. Mm-hmm. And her father, of course, would try to protect the children by to tell them don't get involved in this. You know, you need to stay inside and all this kind of stuff. But they were determined to become involved. So they would sneak out the window and go participate in the marches and things of that nature. Yeah. But one particular march that was taking place, Ruth's brother actually and a group of other black men were arrested. And after they were arrested, they started hearing the women that were also arrested during the demonstration began to scream and holler that the police officers were attempting to rape them. Mm-hmm. And so they were trying to figure out how can we help these women in this particular situation. And so they thought about it for a minute. They looked at the toilet and they pulled the toilet out of the floor and flooded to jail in order to, wow. to stop the raping wow. of those women. And so they had to release them. Now they were beaten on their way out the door, yeah. but they had to release them in order wow. to, you know, repair what was taking place in the jail cell. Another interesting thing that that took place is during the marches, Ruth's home was one of the few homes that actually had a telephone. And so the news media would actually stop and use it. Of course, this was before wireless mm-hmm. technology and all that. So they would actually use their home and get paid, you know, not a whole lot, but just, you know, a donation. Mm-hmm. They used telephones. They used their telephone to make calls back up north to get reports on mm-hmm. what was taking place in the civil rights marches that were taking place. After Ruth and I were married, one of her parents had died. I can't remember if it was a mother or father. But Ruth, one of the things her father did not believe in was women driving. And so Ruth actually could not drive. Okay. And so she didn't understand some of the things that drivers do. If, you know, if you're on a road trip, if your lights flash, mm-hmm. of course, you know, that means that someone is trying to, you know, pass you. So you kind of move to the side. So on our way to Selma, we actually stopped in Montgomery to get gas and stopped, got gas, got back in the car and began to drive down 80 towards Selma. And a car came up behind me, flashed their lights. And so I knew to move over. And as I began to move over, Ruth started screaming. And she actually grabbed the steering wheel, almost killed us, to be quite honest with you. And she started hollering at me, "What are you doing? What are you doing? Don't stop, don't stop, don't stop." And I said, "Ruth, you know, let the steering wheel go. You're going to kill us, you know." And I finally pulled over, you know, quickly enough to the side. The car went around me, and I said, "Ruth, what is that about? Is that you can't grab the steering wheel like that while we're driving?" And she said, "I had a flashback." She said, "You know, when we were kids, we would hear stories about the Klan driving up behind you, family in cars, flashing their lights, pretending they're the police, mm-hmm. when they actually were Klansmen, and they would pull you out the car and beat you." You know, yeah. And so she thought that's what was about to happen. Mm. And of course, she didn't know, but I was not traveling alone mm-hmm. with just her and the kids. And I had something to deal with the yeah. situation if it were going to turn into something like that under my seat. But but fortunately, I've never had to worry about anything like that. And but it was amazing to hear her talk about some of the stories and some of the things that they had to deal with, even as it pertains to voting.
Yeah.
Because even after in Alabama, with so many black people still in it, mm-hmm. in this state, and it's still a red state, and there are things I still don't understand, you know, as to why. But she would say to me that, she posed this question to me. Let me put it this way. Do you have any idea why Bull Connor, George Wallace, still got elected after we mm-hmm. got the right to vote? And I said, you know, Ruth, I never thought about it. And she said, because there would be surrogates that would come into our communities. And I think when I think about Tim Scott, and I think about Clarence Thomas, all right, and some of those that are that, that are so adverse to the things that we believe in, you know, there would be black surrogates that would come into our communities with truckloads of groceries, and they would hand them out to those in the community, and they'd say things like, "You see, George Wallace is not so bad at all. Look at what he's doing." This is during the time when voting was taking place. Pickup trucks of groceries and dropping them off at homes. And this is what Governor Wallace has done for you. This is what Bull Carter, you know, has done for you. And I was just amazed at that.
Yeah.
And but what that tells me is that from that type of thinking is why we have the Tim Scotts of the world, you know, and the Clarence Thomases of the world today. Because there are those that are thinking more about themselves, because of course those that were passing out those groceries were probably getting paid, you know, a good little bit in order to influence those in the community against voting, you know, against against them. But anyway, I just thought I would throw that
in.
This is some history, some terrific things that you would know.
I mean, such a contrast growing up, as you said, in your sort of closed community, in Houston to her environment in Selma. And how different that experience influenced both of you.
And
so you meet
And you know, and I've said for some time now that really I am one that I've always had friends of different colors and things of that nature, but really our communities were destroyed. Our businesses were destroyed, you know, after, you know, after we began to really become more integrated, you know, in Harris County and in Houston, which I still, you know, I think is good for society that it changed. But but certainly the economics for our communities changed after, you know, after things became more integrated.
When you went to high school, were they segregated schools?
Yes, they were. They were. And and Cashmere, now I graduated from a new school, same school, but you, well, I'll give you a little bit more history about me. I graduated from Cashmere High School, but we a new school was built called Francis Scott Key. And the idea was for us for the Cashmere High School to remain and keep that name, and we was going to go to Francis Scott Key. And you know, some of us thought, hell, we're not going to graduate from Francis Scott Key. We're going to Cashmere all of our lives and everything, you know. And so my first involvement in understanding the political process and how mobilization can get things changed was when we found out that that name change was going to take place in this new school. And the new school was beautiful. And it was supposed to have been a school where white students and white teachers were supposed to come to. And and we got white teachers, but we never got white students. Never got white students. And the white teachers were great. I mean, we really enjoyed them, had great relationships with some of them. But we never got white students. But getting back to the name change, and so me and a couple of my friends said, we do not want to graduate from Francis Scott Key. We want to graduate from Cashmere. We've been there for 6 years. And so we actually got petitions signed in the neighborhood, took them to the school board and presented them. And we were able to, they changed their minds named the old school that we were leaving, or the old building, I should say, we were leaving. They named it Francis Scott Key, and the new school kept the name Cashmere High School. So, interesting.
And so Francis Scott Key, the author of the Star-Spangled Banner,
right.
And ironically, the third verse talks about hunting down slaves.
Yes.
And, you know, which, did you know that at the time?
No,
you
were just, know that at the
you
time.
Just wanted to keep the name Cashmere.
Right, but I did find that out later. Though.
Yeah, okay. All right. Very interesting. So you're Tuskegee, you meet Ruth. How do you wind up back in Houston again?
Well, I believe it or not, my dad was on strike.
Mm-hmm.
With there was a I actually mentioned to my father that I wanted to go to summer school. I was going to school to be an engineer,
mm-hmm.
And decided that I just didn't like all that damn math stuff that you had to learn in order to become an engineer. And at Cashmere, I had a government teacher say to me, after watching me give a presentation on some case, I don't even know what the case was now, she said, if you don't go to school to be an attorney, you'll regret it the rest of your life.
Mm-hmm.
I regret it the rest of my life. I have. And
well, we don't.
After went, yeah, but I do. Yeah. And anyway, so I told my dad I want to change my major. Mm-hmm. I decided I want to change my major and do something different. And he said, well, I don't know if I'll be able to send you to summer school because we're planning a strike against AT&T.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember now if it was 71 or 72,
mm-hmm.
but they were actually going on strike to win the right to not have to pay for their health care.
Mm-hmm.
Now think about that a minute.
Yeah.
They were actually paying premiums for health care. And they won that strike. They won it. And one of the saddest things that has happened to me since I have been an officer in this union is giving up that right again and having our members have to pay for their health care costs.
Okay.
And I made sure that that my local voted it down, and I talked to our members about the contract passed, unfortunately, but it did not pass in Houston, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. I said I could not live live with myself knowing, yeah. and my dad is probably turning over in his grave,
yeah.
knowing as an officer of this union what he went on strike for, and I could not, I mean, because I went on strike. It killed my college career.
Mm-hmm.
I actually started working at grocery stores and stuff and decided, mm-hmm. well, hell to hell with college. And during that time, Ruth and I had gotten closer. She got pregnant, mm-hmm. and we married, mm-hmm. and we've been together for, you know, 53 years now.
Wow.
One of the best things that ever happened to me in my life.
Yeah.
But that deterred me from finishing and started me on my career working.
Yeah. Yeah. So when do you wind up
making a living for this baby?
When do you wind up at the phone company?
So you know, I went to different jobs for years, I worked at grocery stores, started getting involved with labor unions at the grocery stores at that time. United Food and Commercial Work, I think I was a member there for a short period of time. Mm-hmm. Then I got promoted to some position. That I think I started out as a sacker, then I became a stocker, and you know, I didn't think I wanted to go to work, you know, where my dad worked, but actually had been terminated from a job. I actually applied for a job at AT&T, didn't hear anything from them, and I got into some type of dispute with my manager. And again, I think it's because Ruth's second parent passed away, and I ended up staying a couple of days later than I had thought I needed. Well, anyway, there was some miscommunication between me and management on how long I was going to be off, mm-hmm. to put it that way, and so I was terminated. And riding a bus back to my apartment, and I passed by an AT&T building where the hiring took place. And it's almost like a voice from the sky said, you need to stop and check on your application. And I stopped and went in, and this supervisor saw me. She had a stack of applications on her desk, and she said, Claude, we were going to give you a call. Thank you so much for coming in. We're gonna hire you. And I thought, now, you know, how could she have thought that she was just gonna hire me you know, and, you know, got all these applications on our desk. The consent decree had just taken place.
Right.
She saw that I was black. Mm-hmm. She said, here comes one.
Yeah.
Here's one we can hire, you know.
Right on time.
Right on time. That's exactly what, and listen, that's just the truth. Because I was not going to stop.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, I was getting ready to volunteer to go into the Army.
Wow.
To take care, you know, take care of my children. Because I think by that time, Ruth, I think we had two children.
Yeah.
And so...
So what year is this now?
And so that's it. This was 1973.
Okay.
1973.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
And so AT&T was looking for black people to hire, and into technical positions now, right? As well as move women from operator positions into technical positions. Right. So all of that was taking place, you know, around that time. Yeah.
So you say AT&T, but at the time it was Southwestern Bell?
It was Southwestern Bell.
Yeah.
It was Southwestern Bell at that time.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, no, it was actually AT&T.
Okay.
Because I think after that, the Bell system broke up after 73. Yeah, it was actually AT&T during that period of time.
Okay.
If I remember correctly. Yeah. And then it became Southwestern Bell.
Okay.
Oh, have I got it backwards?
Well, I think the breakup of the Bells was in the 80s, right? What year was it?
1984.
84 was when AT&T was broken up into the Baby Bells.
Well, it might have been Southwestern Bell.
Yeah, I'm sure it was.
Yeah, it was Southwestern Bell. It was Southwestern Bell at that time.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was Southwestern Bell at that time.
A subsidiary
of AT&T.
Right.
That's
exactly.
What it was. Right.
Exactly.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Right. So, as a matter of fact, I might have had something to show you guys. Can it be paused?
Of course.
Why don't you pause it just a minute?
Yeah.
Let me see if I can find it. Yes, so that's my father's first perfect attendance award. He received a pin for perfect attendance.
Wow. Yeah, it says Southwestern Bell Telephone Company.
Yeah, so it was Southwestern Bell.
Perfect attendance. Claude Cummings. He had his name engraved on it even. Wow. What a great keepsake.
Yeah.
Huh? Now, Claude III get that pen?
He probably will. Yeah. I don't know if he won't. Yeah. He'll probably trash it.
No, he won't.
Yeah, and this is a Western Electric contract book.
Wow.
Installation division from 1947 to 1949.
Wow.
I guess he just had that.
Yeah, yeah.
But I thought I would share that with you also.
Oh, look at that. About 30 pages.
Yep.
Compared to our contracts today. Wow. Okay.
Okay.
So you wind up, you're now at the phone company. What job are you hired into at the phone company?
Okay. All right. Are we on?
Yeah.
Okay.
We're back on.
Okay.
Yep.
All right. Yep. So, anyway, I got hired and as a frame attendant,
mm-hmm.
1973, as a frame attendant. My very first day on the job, I had a job steward walk in and say to me, you know, this is what you need to do if you want to make sure that you continue to stay employed. Mm-hmm. You need to sign a union card. And of course, you know, I was able to tell him that, but my dad is a union member, so I knew to do that. I was just waiting for someone to approach me.
Yeah.
The other interesting thing is the technicians that were there at that time did nothing to help me.
Yeah.
Absolutely nothing. What they said to me is, you know, you'll have a partner coming soon.
Mm.
And I said, okay. And so there was a block that was set up on the frame. And so I just spent my days soldering that, you know, wires on that block. No interaction. And nothing like that.
So was this resentment because of the consent decree or what?
You know,
just
flat racism.
Yeah.
Just simple as that. Simple as that. You know, they told me I had a partner coming, and sure enough, a week later, a black female showed up, and she was my partner, Sharon Hudson is her name, Sharon and I are still friends today, and we often laugh about those days And I loved it because, man, she was beautiful.
Yeah.
She was absolutely beautiful. So I had fun.
Yeah.
Nothing. We were just friends. Yeah. You know, so for, just for the record, just for the record, we were just friends.
Right.
But I didn't mind coming to work.
Yeah.
You know, and the next thing is we worked their asses in the ground.
Yeah.
Boy, the two of us could run some jumpers. And we've got we actually got a lot of overtime. Sharon and I did because we got to know the frame so well, and we worked so hard because we had to prove ourselves, right? We had to prove that we could actually do the work.
So this the steward that comes around and we can do a lot of pausing around here for that.
Kshmere.
And this was in Houston.
Houston,
right?
Yes.
Okay, so we good? Is it faded out?
Yeah.
Okay. So this steward approaches you about signing a membership card. I assume male, white male?
White male.
And then basically, is he part of the group that turns his back on you at
No,
that
he
point?
Didn't actually work on that floor.
Okay.
Yeah, he worked in the building, but it was a toll building. So I worked at the Jefferson Toll Building in downtown Houston.
Okay.
But that was,
you
need to sign a union card.
Were you able to break down this barrier with your white coworkers some point?
After a while, things got better. Let me just put it that way. And I think, again, it's because of our work ethic. You know, you never know what people believe and what they think and what they hear. Right. I mean, during that period of time, I'm sure there were many who thought, you know, we got these black workers, you know, they're not going to know how to do this work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're going to slow us down. Or they're not going to properly be able to grasp, you know, what takes place here. And we were able to show them differently.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean, just like my dad was able to show those that had questions about their ability to be able to do things, you know, because there were questions about can black people actually do this this work, you know? Are they taking our jobs?
Yeah.
You know, those kind of things, right? They took place even then, just like some of the crap that you hear, you know, Trump talk about now, right?
Right.
So
immigrants are going to take the black jobs.
They're going to take black jobs. They're going to take the black jobs, right? Yeah.
He's so tone deaf.
Yeah.
Just incredible.
I'm telling you, my black job is to make sure his ass don't get back in the White House again. That's my black job.
That's good.
And I'm doing everything I can to bring other black jobbers on with me to make sure it gets done.
Good for you.
Right. Yeah. So I think that's it because we were the only two.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you know, you find out in life that after people sit down and actually talk with each other about things, our lives are not that different.
Right.
We have children, we have families, you know, we have loved ones, we have, you know, we have everyday issues in life that we have to deal with. Our principles, for the most part, are the same, right? And you know, you just you begin to blend.
Yeah.
What I've said time and time again is more people need to get in a room and just talk to each other about things that that go on in their lives, and they'll find out that they have so much in common.
Yeah.
You know, if you just get past the color, you know, of your skin.
Yeah.
Right. And so, anyway.
So, you're working on the frame.
Yes.
At some point, what's the genesis of your union involvement? Where does that What's the spark there?
So interesting. You know, after some years of working on the frame and then actually moving into a communications technician position, I had a couple of people reach out to me about becoming more involved and going to union meetings.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be honest with you. There was a lot of job growth during that period of time in the city, and AT&T was beginning to expand, and so I was working a lot of overtime, And so I could care less about meetings. I was enjoying the money, mm-hmm. to be quite mm-hmm. honest with you.
Sure.
And also enjoying, you know, going to happy hour, because there was a club right down the street from where the building was. So I could care less. The Union Hall was on one side of the Jefferson Toll building. The nightclub that I enjoyed going to was on the other side of the building. And there were times when I would say to myself, I don't know if I want to go to a union meeting or I want to go to the bar, because sometimes union meetings weren't all that great, mm-hmm. right? But I started attending, and
who's the local president at this time?
A local president at that time was M. E. Nichols.
Okay.
Yeah. M. E. Nichols. Yeah. M. E. Nichols was the president.
Okay.
And it might have been. Let me see. Might have been Tommy Parsons.
Okay.
Now that I think about it, when I first started, it was probably Tommy Parsons.
There's some very famous names came out of that.
Yeah. That local. Very famous. You know.
Parsons, Joe Gunn, Emmy Nichols.
I'm gonna tell you a Joe Gunn story is gonna blow your mind.
Okay. All right. Good.
Trust me, it's gonna blow your mind.
All right.
So anyway, we began to you know, more and more black people began to get hired on. Some of us began to hear about these different committees that legislative committees and other committees. And so I decided to just start attending some meetings, and we joined some committees and found it to be quite interesting, but still nothing that whet my appetite enough to ever mm-hmm. want to be a union leader, because I'd hear about, you know, some of the at those mm-hmm. meetings, some of the crap that was going on and the fights, and, you know, they screaming and hollering at the officers during officers' meetings, and say, I don't want to be part of that shit. And so, but there did become a time when people of color began to say, you know, it's when are we going to be able to see someone that's sitting on that podium that looks like us? And a young lady I got to know pretty well, her name was Valeria Simmons, decided from Operator Services, mm-hmm. decided that she wanted to become more active and run for office. And so I would say that was probably the one person that started talking to me more mm-hmm. about getting involved.
Mm-hmm.
Around the union and doing things. So we began to attend meetings, and I think I was on the community services committee. I joined the legislative committee, and so I began to get active there. And then somewhere in that time frame, and you know I should know this, but I don't. CWA Minority Caucus started to get formed,
mm-hmm.
was beginning to, you know, getting to make noise with, you know, Dennis Surrett
mm-hmm.
and others began to talk about the need for there to be more involvement of people of color mm-hmm. in CWA. And again, the time frame escapes me, but I know we have it in history somewhere. The black leaders or black activists, I guess, mm-hmm. you know, in CWA decided to form the CWA Minority Caucus.
Right.
And that first meeting was held, if I remember correctly, in Detroit.
Okay.
Pause one second.
Okay, yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
So I can ask the spelling again. Valeria?
Valeria. V-A-L-E-R-I-A. Valeria. Right.
L-E-R-I-A. Simmons. With
right.
two M's.
Yes.
Okay. Thanks. I'm guessing you're talking early. Well, you were hired on in 73.
Right. So this had to be
late 70s.
Late 70s, early 80s. But there was a call of action to bring black leadership into Detroit, just mm-hmm. to talk about, you know, how mm-hmm. do we move forward, you know, how can we make sure that there's some black representation.
I'll be back online.
Yeah.
We're good. Okay.
And I'll look for it because I've got that history somewhere.
Yeah.
To be honest with you. Yeah. You know, I've got it somewhere.
That time frame seems about right. Late 70s, early 80s. Right. Seems like what the
right.
origins.
Late 70s, early 80s
yeah.
is
yeah.
when it took place in Detroit.
So you go to this meeting in Detroit?
And so, yes. Okay. Yes. And so when we heard about this meeting, right, we decided we wanted to attend. Some of us wanted to go. And I've forgotten the committee that we were on at that time because it wasn't an equity committee, but it was some committee that dealt mm-hmm. with the rights of people of color. So I don't know. Maybe it was just some group we started ourselves.
Might have been folded into community services at the time.
Something like that.
Right,
you know.
Right.
But we approached the leadership about going. And they said, hey, did you go to a meeting like that? We don't need nothing like that here. Everybody's fine. You know, we treat y'all great. Yeah, the local officers, we treat y'all great. You know, why y'all want to go to something like that? And I said, well, we'd like to go. You know, and so we actually began to mobilize, mm-hmm. and understood clearly that we had to write as members to get the membership to vote to support us. And so I mobilized some members and brought them down, and we put a motion on the floor that the local fund some of us going to these meetings, and that actually happened. Hmm. And
at the time, 6222 is a big local.
It's a big local, yeah. You know, around 10,000 members.
Yeah.
And so it's not that they couldn't afford it.
Right.
They had the money, they had the resources.
But what's the racial makeup of it in this late 70s, early 80s time frame? I mean, still predominantly white.
Still
I presume.
Predominantly white, but but I would say because we had so many black operators
mm-hmm.
and so many that were beginning to get into clerical type jobs, mm-hmm. I would say a good maybe 30% of that membership, especially because we had a huge operator services unit.
Yeah.
That was just full of black women,
yeah.
to be quite honest with you.
And what about Hispanic membership at that point?
Not as many Hispanic.
Okay.
Yeah, Hispanic turnout began to increase in later years.
Mm-hmm.
But the black turnout was, black membership was really expanding.
Yeah,
it was.
Okay, so you get a taste
of... So I get a taste of this,
right?
And get a taste of this, and so I began to get... more active. I said, you know, this is good.
Mm-hmm.
This is really good. And during that period of time, we decided that we were going to run Valeria for an office. Mm-hmm. And of course, it was all kind of uproar about that. Oh my God, they're getting ready to run a black person for an officer in this union. What the hell are we going to do? What's wrong with them? So each one of us would have little meetings with white leaders and white, y'all don't need to do this. We're fine. We love y'all. We'll take care of you. You know,
just stay in your place.
Things are great.
Yeah.
Stay in your place.
Yeah.
You know, stay in your place. And there was a gentleman named Monarchy Clay. Monarchy was a, listen, he was a great looking guy. Let me just put it that way. Okay. He was a good looking guy.
Right.
If I was going to remake myself one day, you know, I'd probably say, man, I'd like to look like that guy right there. Because he didn't have any problems, you know, getting dates or anything like that. You know, I mean, he was just a great, great guy, great personality.
Mm-hmm.
But 6222 had a history that I learned about after I got active because remember now I said I was going to the clubs, mm-hmm. you know, but there were other black people that were going to meetings. Whenever, especially a black man, decided he was going to get active, the leadership would either work with management to promote you or to get you fired.
Wow.
And that's a fact. a fact. And so minorities started organizing and mobilizing, and women were, it was single, women were falling in love with him, both black and white. Mm-hmm. And so he was really seen as a real threat, mm-hmm. because not only black women like this guy, but these white women like him too, mm-hmm. you know? And so they promoted Menarche. We got Menarche promoted, convinced him he couldn't win. And,
wow.
And, you know, he took a management position, and he's still living today. Matter of fact, we live almost in the same communities, and we talk about those days.
I'll be
honest with you. And what he says to me is, Claude, I'm glad you hung in there.
Yeah.
You know. And so he got promoted. Valeria, they tried to promote Valeria. Valeria would not get promoted, and she was smart enough to know how to be careful not to get fired, right?
Right.
And right. So Joe Gunn, who at that time had left 6222, and Joe Gunn, in my opinion, was a guy who could strategize against AT&T better than any leader mm-hmm. that I'd ever experienced
mm-hmm.
during that period of time.
Yeah.
He would actually put videos up against the AT&T building. I mean, a movie camera, and just, you know, Ma Bell sucks, and that kind of stuff. Ma Bell is a bad mama, that kind of stuff. Just absolutely aggravate AT&T. I mean, he was just brilliant mm-hmm. when it comes to some of the things and some of the tactics that he would use to piss them off, you know. He and Emmy Nichols. Emmy Nichols got me clearly to understand the importance of having political power. And so getting back to Valeria, after it was apparent that that everyone could see that we'd mobilized enough members to talk about making a difference mm-hmm. And needing to make a difference, that Joe Gunn was called in from his position as president of the Texas AFL-CIO, because mm-hmm. that's what he had ascended to in that period of time. Mm-hmm. And he actually came to the membership meeting and made a motion. He nominated her, then talked to her. He actually nominated her for the position, and talked about that it's time, you know, for there to be some difference in the way that the leadership of the union looks like. And she actually won. Yeah, she won. So she was the first black elected member of Local 6222. Hmm. And so
she broke the glass ceiling.
She broke the glass ceiling.
Yeah. Good for her.
But
is she still with us?
But unfortunately, no, she's not.
Oh.
Now she passed away.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, you know, made some errors.
Oh, it's too bad.
You know, one of the things that she did that that just broke, you know, I just, you know, you wonder sometimes. One of the things I've always tried to do is listen to advice and ask for advice. And I'm not afraid to let people know what I know and what I don't know. I would say to all of you, that's probably one of the things I think the staff here, directors, mm-hmm. like about me. Mm-hmm. If there's something I just don't know, I just tell them I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't try to make up stuff. I am who I am, you know. And I need y'all's help and doing whatever it is they want me to do that I don't know. You know, and they've been great and giving me what I need. Right. And and I think they're appreciative of that and appreciative of the way that I help them, you know, what they do. But anyway, one of the things that she did was bought a Jaguar during the downturn in the U.S. economy with cars.
Mm-hmm.
I begged her not to do that. I said, whatever you do, please don't buy a Jaguar. I mean, I understand you like a Jaguar, but the U.S. auto industry is struggling. Mm-hmm. You can't pull a union, non-union car up to the union hall as an mm-hmm. officer. You can't do that, you know. She did it.
Mm-hmm.
She paid the price for it.
Yeah.
Because she was a one-termer.
Yeah.
And,
so when do you first get elected?
So that happens. And I'm pretty distraught after that, because I thought, you know, Valeria was, she represented our members well. There were some things that she should have done differently. That was one of them, right? And so anyway, that happens, and life goes on.
Yeah.
And I think it's during the election that she lost, that we elected some new officers, and I think it was our first or second Hispanic officer in the local.
Mm-hmm.
I've become pretty active during that period of time with legislative committee, and mm-hmm. gotten to know politicians, and so I began to have an appetite for possibly running for a position, especially after Valeria lost. Because I thought to myself, you know, we're going to have a black person run the first, and then they fail. Only one term, you know, I said, and that's not representation of what I believe black people can do, or a black person can do if they get elected to this office. But they just have to act differently. And one of the things that I learned early in life is, and I did this even when I was elected president of my class, I understood clearly, I worked for the class. The class didn't work for mm-hmm. me.
Yeah.
Okay. I worked for the class. And that's what my entire career has been about. I work for the members. Mm-hmm. The members don't work for me. I understand we're going to have differences and things of that nature sometimes, but it's my job to work for them,
mm-hmm.
you know, in any way that I could. And so I began to get an appetite about possibly running for an office. And after Callaway got elected, and this young Hispanic guy, Robert Fuentes, got elected, and some others, you know, I thought to myself, those guys, people like them. They really moved out a bunch of older officers that were there, and I said, they'll probably be there for a while. I said, you know, there's no way that, you know, I'm going to be able to run anytime soon. So life continues, right? And then, you know, CWA develops the Committee on Equity, and there's some other things that take place. And I'd be damned if not the same issue that we had. And I don't know if it was under Nick, Joe Gunn, or I think it might have been Tommy. I can't remember the event in Detroit that they didn't want to pay us to go to. Callaway says, we don't need equity committees. We don't need that. Why y'all want to go to that stuff? We're fine. You know, everything's great here. And so Callaway's white. Okay. Yeah, they're white, you know, white, you know, and Callaway well liked, mm-hmm. you know, tall, you know, mm-hmm. nice looking guy and everything. I met with them rather than start up, you know, something up on the floor. I said, what is wrong with you guys? I said, we're just going to get better educated. You know, it's obvious that there needs to be a change, not only here, but for our union to come up with a program like this. They evidently see that something needs to be done to try to train people of color, you know, how to lead in this union and how to get better involved. The more involved people are, the better off we are. What is y'all's problem with that? You know, well, we just don't think we need that here. It just starts problem. It starts, you know, separating people, you know, and that's about separating people, you know. I mean, there's a need. So anyway, they decide they're not going to send anybody to be a part of, and I can't remember what type of meeting it was, but it was a meeting to talk about the need to get more people of color involved. And so I mobilized a group and we got paid, you know.
We are paid to attend.
Was this and now a official committee of this, the National Union?
Yes, yes, yes.
But the National Union was...
The National Union was having some type of event. It might have been the first equity conference or something like that that was mm-hmm. taking place, you know.
And the local had to pay.
And the local would have to pay us to go, to attend. And they just did not want us to go.
Mm-hmm.
But after they observed that,
mm-hmm.
they began to get concerned about yeah. about me. And I need to say this, that prior to that happening, I did run for an executive board. I ran for an executive board
mm-hmm.
Position. I think it was in the cycle before these guys won and lost. I lost by, I think, there were two of us that were running for positions, and I don't know why as well as I know the other guy, but and we had gotten pretty popular, to be quite honest with you, because we gotten pretty active in the local, both of us. Why can't I think of his name? I'll think of it and give it to y'all later. But I lost by 11 votes, I think somewhere between 7 and 11 votes. I think the other guy lost by like 20 votes, very close. The election chair, when he announced the results, resigned immediately. And he said, and I'll never hold another election again.
Hmm.
And I was told we didn't lose those elections, but there were ballots that were disqualified, so we wouldn't win. And he was honorable enough that, yeah. you know, they weren't going to let him,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
change anything. But he resigned. And I never saw him again.
Huh.
Never saw him again.
Wow.
Yeah. And so anyway.
So how were the elections conducted? Not to digress.
That by ballots.
A mail ballot?
By mail ballot.
Okay.
By mail ballot. Yeah. By mail ballots. Yeah. And so that took place. And so now, so let me move forward. So we're at this position now where. You know, we get the votes we needed in order to go to this event. We come back, and then we just start getting, you know, more active in the local. Callaway had been elected maybe 3 or 4 or 5 months, you know, when we had that happen. Mm-hmm. And then I'm working on the 13th floor of the building in downtown Houston. Again, the Union Hall is right across the street. And so one day on the one other part, because I need to set this history up correctly. We had three secretaries that worked at our mm-hmm. Union Hall. Mariana was one of them. When my dad was working for the company, Mariana at that time was a teenager that sold additional life insurance to mm-hmm. members that might want it, that mm-hmm. the union was sponsoring. And so she would handle my dad whenever my dad would come to handle business. You know, my dad would get would pay her. All right. So move forward all these years. Miranda is still there, but now she's a secretary. You know, I think she was just a clerk or some title. But I'm not sure that she was a permanent employee of the union, but she's a permanent employee now. And so so I worked on the 13th floor of the toll building, and I look outside, and three of the secretaries are outside eating lunch. I didn't think much about it. Mariana was Italian. The other two ladies were white. But I thought to myself, they're getting a tan, right? And so that day passed. The next day, I look out the window. They're outside. And I said, that's strange, they're eating outside, you know. But it was either the third or fourth day, something strange happened. I looked out, it was raining, and they were outside eating under umbrellas. And I said, something is strange here. And so I took a break, went over and talked to them. I said, Mariana, why are you guys out here eating lunch in the rain? And she said, Claude, you know those new officers, Callaway and others y'all elected? Yeah. They directed us to take our breaks and lunches in the women's restrooms. And I said, what? Now, mind you, we have two buildings. 6222 was a well-funded, a lot of money. We had
a two-story building on the front, had a two-story meeting hall with a restaurant at the bottom. We were told that we can't have our breaks or our lunches in the restaurant, and we can't have them in the office building with the men. We have to take our breaks and our lunches in the women's restroom. I said, you guys are lying. They said, no. I said, and one other thing, you see that they put a wall up in front of the building, a wall inside. At one time, it was an open space, but they actually put a wall up where we couldn't get to the secretaries. Well, Mariana was beautiful, and could she was a great dancer. She hung out with a lot of black people, and so I said, well, so anyway, I said, okay. I said, y'all take me in. She said, Claude, we can't take you in. She said, because they'll fire us. You know, we can't do that. So we need you to come back tonight, and we'll show you. So I actually drove back that night and went in, and I actually observed a table. That you can imagine, the bathroom is about maybe the size of that door there to the very, very end mm-hmm. of this wall, right? And at the corner, you had the stalls, three mm-hmm. stalls, and you had a table with salt and pepper on it and napkins. Ugh. And they were told that that's where they had to take their breaks and lunches. And then I saw this wall. I said, well, why have they got this wall separating? They said, well, that's to keep the niggas from Mariana. Because Mariana would go out with black men. And they would come and see her. And so this was to keep, that's exactly what they said, you know. And so I said, well, this is pretty damn shocking. I said, well, what are y'all, who's standing up for y'all? You know, who's doing it? Nobody. I said, Claude, they have terrified everybody. They're scared. We're scared for our jobs if we speak out. Our own union, because they were OPEIU. Mm-hmm. Our own union is even afraid to speak out. And I said, well, somebody's got to speak out for you guys, you know? And again, I would go to union meetings, but I didn't know anything about Robert Rules of Order. I didn't know anything about, you know, how these, you know, really meetings are handled. I just go and listen half the time, you know. We'd had a few drinks before, so shit, I was just there so I could sign my name and say I was there and gone, you know. And so anyway, I said, well, this is not right. And they said, well, Claude, it's not, but people are afraid. And so I said, well, I'm not afraid. And so the next membership meeting packed about 400 people. We had large union meetings, 400 or 500 people in that building. And I was scared to death. And so they opened up the meeting like they know. And I hope I'm not taking too long. And if I am,
great.
Yeah,
keep going.
Yeah. I opened up the meeting and with a prayer and Pledge of Allegiance. And I jumped up to Mike. I said, listen, I need to talk about something. Remember, Cummins, you just can't jump up at the mic. You know, we have, you know, we got rules. We got reports and stuff we got to go. So I set my lesson back down. I said, okay. And so I think Kara started talking about something. And I jumped up at the mic again. I said, listen, I've got something I need to talk about. And people started laughing, you know. And Kara said, you just remember Cummins? What's your name? I said, Cummins. I said, my name is Claude Cummins. Well, you need to sit down. And I said, well, I got something I need to talk about. Well, you need to sit down, you know. And so one of the officers gave a report. It might have been Weldon Betts. I don't know if you remember Weldon Betts. Yeah. You remember Weldon?
I do.
Yeah, yeah. I can't remember who it was, but he gave a report, and I jumped up at the mic again, and I said, listen, I've got something I need to talk about here. And they said, well, Mr. Cummins, we have Robert Rules here. You just can't do this. I said, well, where Mr. Rules at? I'll talk to him. I know Robert Rules. I knew nothing about meetings. You know, I said, where Mr. Rules? I'll talk to him about it. It's embarrassing now. But, you know, I've had some people say, Claude, I can't believe you even say that publicly. I said, well, I just tell the truth.
Yeah.
You know? And so I had a black woman grab me and pulled me to the side. And set me down. I said, what in the hell are you trying to do? And I explained it to her. And she said, you need to get up, wait until new business, get up on the new business, make a motion that the secretaries that work for the union should not be treated in it. Well, just to make a motion that women secretaries should have a right to take their breaks and lunches where everybody else does. And then you tell them that the women that work for the union should be treated worse than our members who work for AT&T. Yeah. Right. That's what you'll say when they actually make comments. And so I did that. Got a standing ovation. Okay, a standing ovation. And
I'm guessing the build-up helped.
Yes. Because they want to, what's this
type of? Yeah, right, this is going to be good.
Yeah,
right.
Whatever it is, it's going to be something. Yeah. I got a standing ovation. I was nervous. I was so scared. And I said, I'm getting my ass out of here and going to get a drink down on the other side of the club just as quick as I can, you know. And on my way, a beeline to the door, a group of members grabbed me. And this is what I'm fixing to say here. Mm-hmm. Think about it, and I almost tear up every time I think about it. They took me to the back of the hall and said, a leader is born.
Wow.
I say, a leader is born.
Wow.
That's all they said.
How cool is that?
And they said, we're going to run you for the next position.
Yeah.
We're going to run you for an office. And they ran me for an office, and I've been elected ever since.
Yeah.
I've been elected ever
what
since.
What was the first office you were elected to?
Yeah. Vice President.
Vice President.
Yeah,
okay.
Vice President. Yeah. They ran me 1986. And they ran me too. When I say they ran me, they ran because and then I heard afterwards, Clark, this guy's been hard. The way they talked to people, the way they treated the members, and you know, half the time they drunk. One of them pulled a boat up every Friday to the union hall with the union vehicle hooked to it, and would go. They locked the hall down and just have parties and games. And half the time you couldn't get them to return a damn phone call. As a matter of fact, the guy Robert that I ran against and beat, the young Hispanic guy that I helped and actually gave money to, after he got elected, he told me, I can't talk to you anymore. I'm a vice president. I'm a vice president now. I can't talk to you anymore. I started calling him about some members that were having issues. And so I ran and BJ ran. BJ beat Callaway.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
And I beat this guy. Yeah. That's how we got elected. Wow. That was the team.
Wow.
Yeah. And
BJ's last name.
Etzel. Yeah, Etzel. And we turned that local around.
Yeah.
We did a lot of good stuff. We did BJ and I. And
just as an observer during that time. 6222 had this huge profile for a long time.
Right.
I mean, you know, going the Nichols, Joe Gunn, even Parsons days,
right.
And then vanished.
Yep.
And then, you know, I never heard anything about it again until you
it
guys.
Vanished because of that membership. Yeah. Because of that attitude of those guys.
Yeah.
Those guys were there to do nothing but party and have a good time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
it's
nothing really represent the members. The members were treated horribly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And BJ and I, you know, and some others, we turned it around.
Yeah.
Companies start bringing jobs in, and you know, financially we were off well.
Yeah.
You know, I hated for BJ. BJ tried to move us from downtown, and he never could get that done.
Yeah.
And so I told him, BJ, don't worry about that. I'll make sure we get a building built. You know. But before I ran, they started courting me. Callaway did. They wanted to make me like. Unpaid assistant to the president and all that kind of stuff.
They knew a leader was born too.
Yeah, they knew too. Yeah, they did. Yeah, they did. And so, I was elected and served for 12 years. I've always had an opponent, but I've never lost.
So you served for 12 years as vice president.
12 years as a vice president.
And then.
And in 1986. 1999. Yeah. 1999, yeah. I was elected president.
Okay.
Yeah, I was elected president. And I served for 12 years as president. Built a new building in downtown Houston, beautiful building.
Yeah, I've
in
been
downtown
there.
Houston.
Yeah.
And because BJ BJ wanted to move us away from downtown because the taxes and everything was so high. And the members tried twice. He tried twice, and I tried to help him do it, but he just couldn't get it done.
Yeah.
And I finally told him, BJ, I'll get it done. Don't worry about it. And you'll be the first to know about it once I get it done. And so, interesting story about that. My first speech, I told the members, we got the building is full of mold.
Mm-hmm.
They're old. You know, we've got to build a building. If y'all don't want to go from downtown, fine. But we've got to build a building. And so they said, well, Claude, build it on this lot. And I said, that's fine, because we had a whole block in downtown Houston. So I said, great. That's fine. As long as y'all give me the okay to do it, because we've got to do it. And so we had a groundbreaking ceremony, you know. And mayor came, others came, you know, big deal. And the next day, I get a call from St. Joseph's Hospital. It's right across the street from us. And they said, Mr. Cummings, you know, we saw that y'all had a groundbreaking ceremony over there. You know, we really were thinking about approaching y'all about possibilities, some partnership or doing something with y'all. And I said, listen, y'all can go to hell. I said, we've been trying to build a building for 7 years, and we finally got these members to agree to something. I'm not going to delay nothing. We've had groundbreaking. Goodbye. Thank you for calling. Hung up. Went to sleep that night. My dad came to me in sleep. Said, what is wrong with you? What is wrong with you? I've always told you to sit down and talk with people. You don't treat people like you treat
your
people.
Dad had already passed.
My dad was dead.
Okay.
Yeah, he passed away.
Yeah.
Said, you don't treat people like that. You need to talk with those people. Next day I got up, shook my head. I said, what the hell was that about? You know? But I called him and I said, listen, I apologize. I said, why don't y'all come over and talk with me? And so they did. And they said, Mr. Cummings, we have a lot right down the street. What we'd like to do is just swap lots with you.
Mm-hmm.
I said, just swap lots. They said, yeah. If same size as your lot and everything. I said, no, but there's a difference. I said, there's a difference. I said, this lot right across from the hospital where you guys are. Right behind me is the Toyota Center where the Rockets play. My lot is more valuable than that one. It's nothing but just a lot next to nothing but another freeway. And they said, you're right. And so we swapped lots, and I got $1.5 million cash on top of that. All right? Swap lots. We start to build. Sit down with the building trades. Tell them we're building this building. Y'all need to make sure it's union labor. You need to make sure it's this, that. I don't want no problems with. All right. Get the building. The building gets started. Only to find out after the iron has gone up that it's not U.S. Steel. That is a problem. And that they're not using unionized steel workers.
Yeah. Iron workers.
Iron workers. Iron workers.
Yeah.
Couldn't believe it. And so they bid the job out.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, I don't understand that, because the building trades, I brought him in with the architect, you know, and so to this day, I still don't know how that got so sideways. As a matter of fact, I even went to a meeting and apologized to them. And they said, Claude, no, it's not your fault, because you had a building trades guy there. It's his fault. Mm-hmm. But thank you for coming over. But to make a long story short, I needed $1 million in order to finish paying for the building. So I had that extra million there. And then I ended up having to still borrow money, from the union.
Right.
We had plenty of money. Shouldn't have had to borrow anything to build that building, you know. And then the others would also complain about the fact that, why is he building that big, tall building? Business headquarters is not as big as that building you're building, you know. And and I said, well, it's not about now. It's about the future. And so it's a beautiful building in downtown Houston. That's a church now, because after I left and got elected to president I'm the vice president of the district. They sold the building. I built it for $2.1 million. Mm-hmm. They sold it for $9
million. Wow. It's a beautiful building.
It's a beautiful building. Yeah, but sold it for nice. $9 million. Wow. And so they paid, you know, paid HQ off.
Yeah.
Because we began to lose jobs because of technology too. So the income was running short, was running low, I should say. Mm-hmm. And then they bought a building outside mm-hmm. of the downtown, like BJ always wanted, and they were able to pay cash for it.
Hmm.
They paid cash for that. So that local is debt free. They'll have money for years to come.
Yeah.
You know,
pretty good investment.
So it was a pretty good investment, yeah. to be honest with
that's
you.
Great.
A pretty good investment. So that's that part. And then of course, Mr. Milburn decides he's not going to run for office again. And I was ready to retire because my wife had opened a print shop and everything, that I couldn't get the CWA bug for because everybody thought I was going to use that to my advantage to make politicians use her instead of other printers.
Yeah, yeah. Why not?
And so, and so members, because of the relationship, it becomes so bad in our district between CWA and AT&T. Members from across the district started asking me, Claude, instead of retiring, why don't you consider running for district vice president? And I served, you know, I served 12 years as president. So 12 years as vice president, 12 years as president, 24 years. And I think I was the longest serving officer there. I think Dorothy Barker, the Secretary of Treasury, was the longest mm-hmm. serving, but I was the second longest mm-hmm. serving officer there.
Longest serving president, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so one day, at a retirees meeting, when I'm talking to the retirees about running and the announcement went out and everything, Joe Gunn showed up. And I said, man, this is great. I get Joe Gunn's because still, you know, remember, I'm the first black and mm-hmm. the black male in these positions. First black male vice president, first black president, you know, and now I'm talking about running for vice president of District 6. And I said, Joe Gunn has showed up for this. This is absolutely great, man. I got this thing in the bag, right? And he shows up, you know, I've got about 75 to 80 retirees there and others. And I see him and I see the look on his face like he's upset or angry about something. So I'm trying to figure out what's going on. And he pointed at me and said, you talking about running for office. If you run, it'd be the worst thing that ever happened to this union. The worst thing that could ever happen to this union. It broke my heart. I've never in my life had a white man make me cry.
Yeah.
But I was about to cry because I worshiped the ground that Joe Gunn walked on. Because I thought he was such a great leader.
Yeah.
And he said that to me in front of all those people. And it was because there were so many in that local, even when I ran for president, who said, Claude, you've done a great job as vice president of 6222. You don't need to run for president.
Yeah.
You know, you just continue to work your ass off in that position. You don't need to be the leader. You know, and
another example.
And this is people who I'd help their kids, their mm-hmm. grandkids, and others get hired
mm-hmm.
because I worked to have such a great relationship with management. I could get just about anything I wanted out of management in mm-hmm. Houston, to be quite honest with you. Mm-hmm. And even after I became the District 6 vice president, you know, I was never encouraged to run for high office because everyone always thought I needed to stay where I was.
And once for again, him to stay in your place. Just
absolutely. You need to stay in your place.
Yeah.
You don't need to do that.
Yeah.
You know.
Wow.
And so that was heartbreaking.
Yeah. It had to be disheartening for sure.
Yeah. And after I won, he could never even look me in my face. I remember right now being in Austin at an event. This was shortly before he died. And I just passed by him and I just looked because he just looked like a shell of his former self. And I thought to myself, because there were members that actually, you know, in 6222, we have all the pictures of presidents. Mm-hmm. There were retirees and others that wanted to pull his picture off the wall and take it outside and burn it with him there. That's just how angry they were that he would come down and say something like that. And of course, I ran and won.
One year?
That was 2011? Oh, no. What is that? 20?
Yeah, so let's see.
Well, the arithmetic, if you were elected.
Yeah. Oh, shoot. Now I know when that was. Yeah, 2011. Yeah, 2011.
Okay.
Yeah, 2011. Yeah, 2011.
2011 or 2001?
No, 2011. As vice president of District 6?
District 6, yeah, 2011.
Yeah, yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah. Well, is it fixing to cloud up?
I think it's all right.
Yeah, 2011. Yeah, 2011. 2011. And of course, served 12 years. Everything was 12 years. Amazing, isn't it? Yeah, everything was 12 years. Everything was 12 years. So
there's some biblical connotations to that. I mean, 12 years.
I don't know.
Yeah. It's remarkable.
Yeah.
What a career.
And so, yeah.
What a career.
And now,
serve as District 6 vice president for 12 years.
Right.
And in 20...
Bargained some pretty good contracts there. Mm-hmm. I would say the last contract I bargained was the most unique in that we've got a provision in health care there. I don't know that you even know this, that no other contract in this country has. And it was a contract that we extended.
Mm-hmm.
If you remember, that was, I don't know if you heard this, because it was brought up when I ran.
Yeah.
I made it an extension instead of allowing the members to vote because Randall Stevenson was leaving.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Stanky was coming into office, and he made it clear based on what he had heard about it that it'd be dead on arrival if it was still pending while it was there. And so I talked Chris and allowed me to just make it an extension. And a couple of things that were unique about it is that on top of the provisions for VSP, I was able to get an additional, that was not in the agreement, but we signed an outside agreement to give those who want to retire an additional $50,000 in order to retire.
See what VSP is.
Yeah, voluntary severance payment, okay? And also, any member under that contract that retires stayed on active health care benefits through the life of that agreement.
Oh, wow.
Okay. So, and that agreement is still in effect. So, normally you retire, you stay on active benefits until the next enrollment period.
Right.
Then you're going to retire your benefits.
Right.
But in this particular contract, if you retire, you stayed on active health care benefits.
Hmm.
No other contract has that. Okay.
And when does that extension expire?
Expire next year.
Next year.
Next year.
Okay. So you got your
next
work
year.
Cut out for you next year.
Yeah, next year. Well, Derek does. I don't.
Okay. Somehow I got a feeling you'll get called into the game.
We'll figure it out. But I thought we bargained some great contracts there. I'm surprised that we've, had this strike. Because that's the last thing I'd expect to have a strike, being the first president that actually worked for AT&T in over 25 years.
And this is in the southeastern Bell region.
Southeast, right.
Yeah.
Right, southeast region. But District 9 just turned down their TA, so we've got some fights ahead.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that we'll get there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do. But it's been interesting. My idea, even with this event that's going to take place, and I had reservations about having this, and we've got those workers out on strike, but it still helps me build capacity. Lita Jeffries, a couple of days ago, said to machinist lobbyists, that new president from for CWA, he's really on fire, you know, because what I've tried to do when it comes to meetings with the White House, when it comes to meetings with cabinet members, is meet with them myself, not send a surrogate, but to meet with them myself on issues that are important. Because this, and this is no complaint of Chris at all, so I hope, you know, no one takes it like that. But for whatever reason, he was sending a lot of surrogates. And so when you send surrogates, when you, all you're going to get over there is surrogates, right? And so, and so I've kind of taken a different approach that I've been more hands-on when it comes to dealing with cabinet members and dealing with the White House and with others. And I think what that has done is raised the profile of CWA. And so that's what I'm continuing to do with my civil rights work. We're gonna keep up the good fight, and that's why I'm continuing this, because I want to thank those Congress members that have stood with us, but let them know that there's still a fight, and even if we end up with an agreement with this Southeast contract, we've got the West now that has turned down their agreement. So we may need to put more pressure on AT&T. So my idea of being successful is understanding clearly that no man is an island, no man stands alone. And this idea that CWA, as active as we are, and we are active because every Congress member I've talked to, every senator that I've talked to has said to me, Claude, your workers do such a great job. And I've said to the workers, I've said to others, this is not about me. Even this event that we're having here, you know, this is not about raising my profile. It's about raising the profile of CWA to a higher level to be able to get things done, you know. And, of course, I'm sure y'all heard this. I've been so active talking about this administration and how positive they've been. The president invited me on Air Force One, you know, to fly with him to Detroit for a rally. I mean, that's how we raised up the profile of CWA. Again, it's not about me. It's about the union. It's about the union. And what I want to do with this union is the same thing that Sean Fain has done with the United Auto Workers, right? I mean, he's united the country around issues that were important to them when they had their strikes going on, you know? Now, I don't particularly agree with some of the things that he says and he does, but let's face it, you know, he's looked at as someone that's not afraid to speak out on issues that are important to his workers. And I want to be seen in the same vein.
Just for a little context, you've referred three times to an event.
Yes, the
event
is
right here in the CWA building, you're going to have an event this evening.
So annually, the Congressional Black Caucus this time of year has a week-long conference. And last year, for the first time, CWA hosted a labor event just recognizing the Congressional Black Caucus and the work they've done, the support that they've given CWA on our initiatives, legislation that's important to us. And it was very successful on last year. And so we're having another one this year. This is probably going to be the last one that we are going to have, because I have talked to the AFL-CIO and encouraged them to host this and just let individual unions contribute to make it a real labor event.
Right.
I mean, we're having this event. SEIU is having an event. I think another union might be having an event somewhere. That doesn't make sense when all of us are can have one location. We can all have a real presence and show unity, you know, with the Congress members. And this one is somewhat different because not only are we've invited the Congressional Black Caucus, but also the Hispanic Caucus to participate with us, because they have an event within, another week or so. They'll have their annual convention or conference. So the idea, again, is to expand our territory, expand our capacity to get things done.
Well, you've been very generous with your time. One of the things we like to do before we wrap up is Hannah is not a CWA person. She's our producer of these recordings, and she gets to listen to all this, and then she comes up with questions that you know, that the rest of us that are in house here might not have thought of. So, Hannah, do you have a question? Do you want to?
This is a more general question about your family and your legacy. It's really striking that your father was a member of the Union, but it was essentially segregated at the time, and you, his son, have risen to become the president of the whole Union. So I just want to ask, what does that mean to you?
Man, it means so much. And I often think what my dad would think about me now, you know, because I think initially he didn't know if I was going to make it. I'm serious, in life, period. You know, he was very disappointed because I did not finish college. Very disappointed that I didn't. And but I think that he would be proud of the fact that the union that that he worked for as a janitor at one time, the idea that I now lead that union, I think he would be proud of that. I do. Yeah, I do. And I think about that often. I really do. I really do. Yep.
Thank you. That was all.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, of course.
We went very quickly through your youth.
Yes.
And I think missed an opportunity, so I want to ask this. I know how important your religion has been to the formation of your character, your values. I want to give you an opportunity to talk about that.
Yeah, so I'm strong in my faith. You know, I am a deacon, and my son is my pastor now, and so I'm happy about that. But I've always believed that you treat people the way that you want to be treated, and you know, unlike some of this division that I see taking place now, you know, in this country, you know, I've always reached out. And I think those that I work with on a job will tell you, even during those times when when I was on that block by myself, you know, I was always trying to engage in conversations with others, because I believe in life that we're all equal. I just believe that. I understand clearly, because of the way we've been raised, a lot of us, because of the gap in wages and that kind of stuff over the years, and lifestyles that people have a tendency to just hold on to those things that they believe in and the way they were raised. But again, I've always thought that if we could just sit down and talk with each other, we'd find out so quickly that we have more things in common than we do differently. And I think what my faith has done is helped me get through some pretty challenging times. My faith has gotten me through this strike. I never thought I was nervous about pulling 17,000 workers. That's the largest group of AT&T members that we have in this country right now. And to pull them out on a strike like this is just absolutely amazing. And as Jeff said a couple of minutes ago, I've been somewhat concerned, especially with some of the positions that the bargaining team is taking, on how we get them back. And so I actually prayed a couple of nights ago. As a matter of fact, Nick even said that to me, who was chairing the bargaining over there, because I was at a point where I was actually thinking about pulling the trigger to bring them back in. And I thought to myself, man, how do you bring them back in when you really don't have a win at the table, right, to bring them back in on? And so I prayed. I said, well, God, I need something to be able to. And I have not called any former president or anything about this, because I believe that there are times when you sit in that chair that there are things you got to do yourself to work out, right? We couldn't get AT&T, and this was so strange. Couldn't get them to just do regular bargaining. Their idea of bargaining was, here's the health care we want, and that's the health care wellness type plan that we're going to push on every district in this country. And I said to them, that district does not want that health care plan. And you and that's not bargaining. And so as tough as the bargaining committee has been dealing with some of this stuff, I also feel like they were testing me just to see if I would fold. Because as much as work I've done with AT&T, they understood clearly that I have not been as angry or as aggressive as maybe some of my peers have been when it comes to dealing with them. So I truly do believe that some of it was a test to just see what I would do. And I will tell you that the CEO is concerned. He's really concerned, and they're all concerned about what could possibly take place, you know, with this storm. But I believe me holding strong on my faith, because I was prepared to almost fold a couple of days ago before this storm to bring them in. But after I had that prayer meeting, I decided that I'm not going to do it. And because I stayed firm in my belief that those workers need a win before they come in, this has happened. And now for the first time, we're actually getting them to do what they should have been doing a long time ago, and that's bargain. So I do believe some of it was a test of me and how they're going to have to deal with me. They've come to me on some issues that are before the FCC with their FirstNet program, and I've helped with that. And there was one other issue that escapes me right now that we've helped with. So I have been a good partner, but they have not been a good partner with me. And I let the CEO know that I'm disappointed in this, because this is the last thing I expected to have to do. But I've said this to other companies, you know, and I said to AT&T, don't ever take my kindness for weakness, because you don't stay in a position as long as I have, 38 years elected. I've never lost a officer election. I lost that one e-board election that I believe I never lost, to be quite honest with you. But I've never lost. And it's because I know how to fight. And I'm not afraid to fight. Because again, it's about me representing these members, me working for these members. And that's why I travel like I do. That's where I go like I do. Some of the staff have said, Claude, you know, man, I'm much younger than you. I don't see how you do this. Well, I just have this drive. My mother, speaking of that building, the last public appearance by my mother was in the new building that we built in downtown Houston. And had no idea that she had a tumor. And wasn't malignant, but for some reason or other, she just waited too long to do anything about it. And then she became so ill and became so weak. We did have the surgery. You know, she did not survive the surgery. But as she began to get weaker, she would drive to church. I drove behind her once going to church. She was all over the damn street. And when we got back home, I said, Mom, that's it. No more driving for you, you know. But she would go to church every Sunday, speaking about faith. And then she started skipping Sunday. She'd call me because I would take her to church. She started skipping Sundays. Well, I don't think I'm going to go this Sunday. I don't feel like it, blah, blah, this. I don't this, that. And so I decided to go over and have a conversation with her. Mom, what's going on? Because you know I'm going to go to church, you know, every Sunday. She said, let me just say this to you. You know, when I was younger, I taught school, I taught Bible study, I did this at church, I sung in the choir, and I did all this. She said, you just remember this. Do what you can while you can, because there's going to become a time when you're not going to feel like doing what you used to do, and then there's going to be a time when you can't do anything. And about 4 or 5 months after that, she passed away. And those words that she mentioned have stuck with me. And that's where I get my drive from. Because I know that one day, people, you know, everyone thinks they're going to live forever. You're not going to live forever. And there's going to be a time when you're not going to feel like doing some of the stuff, whether it's because of a physical ailment or you just don't feel like doing it. So if you want to leave an impact, I never want it to be said that I lived on this earth and all I did was suck up air. But I didn't do anything to try to help somebody, you know,
no
help some member.
Yeah. I think you've
and
certainly
so,
made your
yeah.
mark.
And so that's what, you know, that's what drives me.
Yeah.
That's what drives me. Okay. I'm probably taking more time than what y'all have. But,
No. You've been more than generous with your time. I mean, these normally we do 2 hours and you're coming up on 2.5 hours now. This is really generous of you to spend.
Well, I hope
time
I gave
us.
You some good information.
It's terrific. Yeah. Some of these stories are just such a great snapshot of the progression of our history as a union and as a culture as
right.
well. So really appreciate it. Is there something you would tell the next generation of workers in particular that, you know, they should be aware of or that they should be
you
thinking
know,
about?
I was invited to speak at the Consumer Electronics Show in Vegas in January of this year. And, of course, everyone's talking about AI. And yesterday I was in, day before, I was in Seattle at the Microsoft complex. Of course, you know, we've got the contracts with ZeniMax and Activision and probably other workers we might be organizing through Microsoft. I'm just amazed at the technology that has taken place. And some of the people there were just alarmed. Some of the union officers there were alarmed at this technology and what it could possibly do to take their jobs. And I said, listen, even though technology has changed, we all need to remember that unions still stand for the things that they stood for years ago. And I said, how many of you remember beeper companies? And some of them laughed, you know. And I said, listen, I organized the first beeper company in Southwestern Bell back in the 80s. I said, but do you know that a couple of weeks ago, I ran into an employee that, because part of that was Bell, at AT&T, was Southwestern Bell. And we had a provision in it that would allow those workers to go into to AT&T if something happened to the beeper company. They're still working for the company. Now, I said to her, what the hell are you doing? You can't find something other than life, other than work, you know, after all these years. But she's still working. Because we had provisions in that contract that gave her training and an opportunity to stay on the payroll and get trained for other jobs. So we all need to remember that even though the technology has changed, unions still stand for and still do the things that we were designed to do years ago. Job security, training, opportunities to move to different positions, to get training, to do other things. So we need to look at how we can work with these companies to train those that are not going to be around for this new technology to get in other fields, to do other work, because there's still some work that's got to be done, right? And so I would just say to other workers, you know, get trained, but join a union. Help us pass the PRO Act. That would make it much easier for workers to form a union and have worker power on the job and a voice, right? And I think that's why so many young people are involved in unions. I think they saw what happened during the pandemic when workers were treated like crap during the pandemic and just said enough is enough. I think they're tired of all this damn corporate greed. I mean, what is enough money, enough money? You look at Elon Musk, you know, and some of these others that have all this damn money, what does he say if a worker going to strike, get fired? Well, screw you. I want to say something else, but I won't, since it's being recorded, you know. I mean, that's what they're fed up about. When is enough enough, right? And this is why I'm so aggravated with AT&T. As much money as CWA has helped them acquire, the money on the BEAD money, the infrastructure money that we've helped them with, they've asked us to help them with, right? And then they want to try to shove some crap down our members' throats. It's ridiculous. So young people need to stand up and fight back against corporate greed. That's what they need to do, you know? And continue to build this middle class. There would not be a middle class without without the union. And that's what I would say to them.
That's a perfect way to end this.
Yeah. Okay.
Terrific.